Good morning. During the 1950s, I followed this emerging civil rights movement with great interest, but I had no immediate personal impact. It had no immediate personal impact on me until I moved to Williamsburg in September 1960 to take up a faculty position at the college. This was the first time I had lived south of the Mason-Dixon line, and my first direct exposure to the realities of Jim Crow. Superficially, Williamsburg appeared to be a placid community, one that seemingly lacked the tensions and drama associated with the civil rights struggles elsewhere in the South. But, as I learned over the next few months, the calm on the surface was misleading. It covered up widespread resentment among the town's African Americans over numerous instances of racial discrimination. And it well illustrated the limited understanding among even well-intentioned whites of the feelings and desires of the black community. Williamsburg in 1960 was a lily-white town. 6 years after Brown versus Board of Education, the public schools remained rigidly segregated by race. The College of William and Mary was not open to African Americans. The Greyhound bus terminal on North Boundary Street had separate white and colored restrooms and drinking fountains. The Williamsburg Theater in Merchant Square, which was owned by Colonial Williamsburg, would in theory admit African Americans, but in conformity with Virginia's Public Assemblage Act, they had to be separated or seated in distinct roped-off sections so that they were clearly separated from white patrons. Virtually all African Americans refused to subject themselves to such humiliation. If they wanted to enjoy a movie in town, it was possible by going to a drive-in that on Richmond Road across from where Ironbound Road comes in. The color line was drawn in a large range of activities. Blacks were denied admission to hotels. They could not eat in most restaurants, nor could they use the bowling alley. With one or two very minor exceptions, churches remained black or white. So did medical care. Dr. J. Blaine Blayton, a much admired African American, served the black community from an office and hospital of sorts on Prince George Street. But there was no black dentist, and white dentists in town did not treat African Americans, so dental care required a trip to Hampton or Richmond. Until the ratification of the 24th Amendment in January 1964, Virginia's notorious poll tax continued to limit poor folk from voting. This had, by intent, however, a disproportional impact on African Americans. My education into the realities of race relations was enhanced by an organization known as the Williamsburg Area Interracial Study Group. Founded in the spring of 1959, it was composed of several locally prominent blacks and a number of liberally inclined whites. In 1962, when I chaired this group, it became a local affiliate of the Southern Regional Council. Our group was obviously a moderate organization, although given the climate of the times, many white people regarded us as being somewhat radical. Even to find a place to hold a meeting was not easy. The Protestant churches in town refused to let us meet there. We did finally get a room thanks to the priest at St. Bede's, and he made that available to us regularly. What the group did do was to educate its members about the ideas, concerns, and realities of the daily life of those on the opposite side of the racial divide. It seemed to me, incidentally, that our African-American members knew a lot more about the ways and interests of whites than whites knew of blacks. Some of the things we did do might seem to you to be simple or even banal, but one must understand the climate of the times. Racially integrated activities in Williamsburg were rare and viewed by much of the white community with great suspicion. Even, for example, such a simple event as having an interracial Christmas party in 1962 at the First Baptist Church, or the inclusion of an African-American friend of my son's at my son's birthday party. One of our projects was to try to get an African-American dentist to come to Williamsburg. Unfortunately, we failed. Another was to attempt to have our group be allowed to send a representative to what was known as the Williamsburg Community Council. This was a voluntary organization composed of representatives of various local civic organizations. But even this simple request was turned down. I was personally informed, quote, that the time was not yet ripe for such a step. Our interracial organization may have had a very limited impact on Williamsburg in the early 1960s, but for its members, it was not without value. Through it, whites and blacks established friendships that probably would not have otherwise occurred, and our understanding of each other's problems and concerns was clearly strengthened. My involvement in it certainly affected me personally, as it opened my eyes to the widespread poverty in the African-American community in the Williamsburg area, and to the constant obstacles that such people face in accomplishing the ordinary task of daily living. It also led me personally to shift my scholarly interest as an historian to matters of African-American history in an effort to better understand race relations in our multicultural society. To be sure, much remains to be done to achieve justice and equality in race relations, but as my brief review of the early 1960s must suggest, we have come a long ways.